Chapter 1, EMS Systems. Introduction. This textbook serves as the primary resource for the Emergency Medical Technician, EMT, course. It also discusses what will be expected of you during the course and what other requirements you will have to meet to be licensed or certified as an EMT in most states. You will also learn about the differences between first aid training, a Department of Transportation, DOT, Emergency Medical Responder, EMR, training course, and the training courses for an EMT, Advanced Emergency Medical Technician, AEMT, and paramedic. Emergency Medical Services, EMS, is a system. This system's key components and how they influence and affect the EMT and his or her delivery of emergency care are carefully discussed in this chapter. The administration, medical direction, quality control, and regulation of EMS services are also presented. The chapter ends with a detailed discussion of the roles and responsibilities of the EMT as a healthcare professional. Course description. You are about to enter an exciting field. The Emergency Medical Services, EMS, system consists of a team of healthcare professionals who, in each area or jurisdiction, are responsible for and provide emergency care and transportation to the sick and injured. Each emergency medical service is part of a local or regional EMS system that provides the many pre-hospital and hospital components required for the delivery of proper emergency medical care. The standards for pre-hospital emergency care and the individuals who provide it are governed by the laws in each state and are typically regulated by a state office of EMS. When you successfully finish this course, you should be eligible to sit for your state certification exam. A certification exam is used to ensure that all healthcare providers have at least the same basic level of knowledge and skill. Once you've passed this exam, you will be eligible to apply for state licensure. Licensure is how states control who is allowed to perform as a healthcare provider. It is the same principle as taking a test to certify you know how to drive in order to get a driver's license. Different states will refer to the authority granted to you to function as an EMT as licensure, certification, or credentialing. For the purposes of this text, the term licensure will be used. In most states, individuals who work on an ambulance are categorized into four training and licensure levels: Emergency Medical Responder, EMR, Emergency Medical Technician, EMT, Advanced EMT, AEMT, and Paramedic. An EMR has very basic medical training and provides care before the ambulance arrives. EMRs may also perform in an assistant role within the ambulance. An EMT has training in basic life support, including automated external defibrillation, use of airway adjuncts, and assisting patients with certain medications. An AEMT has training in specific aspects of advanced life support, ALS, such as intravenous IV therapy, and the administration of certain emergency medications. A paramedic has extensive training in ALS, including endotracheal intubation, emergency pharmacology, cardiac monitoring, and other advanced assessment and treatment skills. Although the specific training and licensure requirements vary from one state to another, almost every state's requirements follow or exceed the guidelines recommended in the current National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, NHTSA, EMS education standards. This textbook covers the material and skills identified in the 2009 National EMS education standards. This text also covers information needed for EMTs to perform the skills outlined in the 2005 National EMS Scope of Practice Model. In the United States, NHTSA is the federal administrative source for curriculum and related documents. After you have successfully completed any prerequisites of your training institution, you are ready to take the EMT course. Like any introductory course, the EMT course covers a great deal of information and introduces many skills. EMT courses include didactic instruction, knowledge, psychomotor instruction, skills laboratories, and clinical behavior judgment professionalism. Everything you learn in the course will be important to your ability to provide high-quality emergency care once you are licensed and ready to practice. In addition, the knowledge, understanding, and skills that you acquire in the EMT course will serve as a foundation for the additional knowledge and training that you will receive in future years. In addition to the required core content, this text includes additional information that will help you understand and apply the material and skills included in the EMT course. Your instructor will furnish you with reading assignments. It is essential that you complete the assigned reading before each class. Your success in this course will depend on it. In class, the instructor will review the key parts of the reading assignment and clarify and expand on them. He or she will also answer any questions you have and will clarify any points you or others find confusing. Unless you have carefully read the assignment and made notes before coming to class, you will not fully understand or benefit from the classroom presentation and discussions. Creating your own tools, such as flashcards, study questions, and outlines, will help you to retain important information. It will also help to take better notes during class. The EMT course will include four types of learning activities. 1. Reading assignments from the textbook, lecture presentations, and classroom discussions will provide you with the necessary knowledge base. 2. Step-by-step demonstrations will teach you hands-on skills that you then need to practice repeatedly in supervised small group workshops. 3. Summary skills sheets will help you memorize the sequence of steps in complex skills that contain a large number of steps or variations so you can perform the skill with no errors or omissions. 4. Case presentations and scenarios used in class will help you learn how to apply the knowledge and skills acquired to situations you will find in the field. EMT training, focus, and requirements. What is an EMT? EMTs are the backbone of the EMS system in the United States. These men and women provide emergency care to the sick and injured. Some of the patients you will eventually treat are in life-threatening situations, whereas others require only supportive care. The skills needed to safely deliver this care are found within this text. Some of the subjects that will be discussed include scene size-up. EMS operates in a wide variety of environments that can create situations where EMS personnel can be injured, outside in the rain, inside a cluttered house, or anywhere in between. The EMT's primary job is to ensure that he or she is as safe as possible. Patient assessment. Patient assessment is the foundation of any EMS call. You must determine what is wrong with the patient. Patients can have many complaints, and you will learn to determine which complaints are life-threatening. Treatment. As an EMT, you will be providing oxygenation and medication therapies. You will control bleeding and assist patients in the delivery of their babies. In addition to hands-on skills, you will also learn how to manage people who are in emotional crisis and to calm patients and to relieve some of their anxiety. Packaging. Most patients will need to be transported to a facility. This could mean a hospital, clinic, or other medical care facility. You will learn how to transport patients with a wide variety of illnesses and injuries. EMS as a career. Many of you are taking this course because you want to help people. To ensure all EMS providers have a long, healthy career, it is important to teach EMS providers how to take care of themselves. We will discuss job stresses and successful ways to cope with them. Licensure requirements. To be recognized and perform as an EMT, you must meet certain requirements. The specific requirements differ from state to state. You should ask your instructor, learning institute, or your state EMS official about the requirements in your state. Generally, the criteria to be licensed and employed as an EMT will include the following. High school diploma or equivalent. Proof of immunization against certain communicable diseases. Valid driver's license. Successful completion of a recognized healthcare provider basic life support, BLS, cardiopulmonary resuscitation, CPR, course. Successful completion of a state-approved EMT course. Successful completion of a state-recognized written certification examination. Successful completion of a state-recognized practical certification examination. Demonstrating that you can meet the mental and physical criteria necessary to be able to safely and properly perform all the tasks and functions described in the defined role of an EMT. Compliance with other state, local, and employer provisions. The Americans with Disabilities Act, ADA, of 1990 protects individuals who have a disability from being denied access to programs and services that are provided by state or local governments, and prohibits employers from failing to provide full and equal employment to the disabled. To obtain further information about the ADA and employment as an EMT, you should contact your state EMS office. One of the primary responsibilities of each state is to ensure the safety of its residents. As such, states have requirements prohibiting individuals with certain types of legal histories from becoming EMS providers. The specific legal requirements, either misdemeanors and/or felonies, are created on a state-by-state basis. Contact your state EMS office for more information. Overview of the EMS system. History of EMS. As an EMT, you will be joining a long tradition of people who have provided emergency medical care to their fellow human beings. With the early use of motor vehicles in warfare, volunteer ambulances were organized, and personnel went overseas to provide care for the wounded in World War I. In World War II, the military trained special corpsmen to provide care in the field and bring the casualties to aid stations staffed by nurses and physicians. In the Korean conflict, this evolved into the field medic and rapid helicopter evacuation to nearby mobile Army surgical hospital units, where immediate surgical intervention was provided. Many advances in the immediate care of trauma patients resulted from the casualty experiences in the Korean and Vietnam conflicts. Unfortunately, emergency care of the injured and ill at home had not progressed to a similar level. As late as the early 1960s, emergency ambulance service and care across the United States varied widely. In some places, it was provided by well-trained advanced first aid personnel who had well-equipped modern ambulances. In a few urban areas, it was provided by hospital-based ambulance services that were staffed with interns and early forms of pre-hospital care providers. In many areas, the only emergency care and ambulance service was provided by the local funeral home, using a hearse that could be converted to carry a cot and serve as an ambulance. In other places, the police or fire department used a station wagon that carried a cot and a first aid kit. In most cases, these vehicles were staffed by a driver and an attendant who had some basic first aid training. In the few areas where a commercial ambulance was available to transport the ill, it was usually similarly staffed and served primarily as a means to transport the patient to the hospital. Many communities had no formal provision for pre-hospital emergency care or transportation. Injured persons were given basic first aid by police or fire personnel at the scene and were transported to the hospital in a police or fire officer's car. Customarily, patients with an acute illness were transported to the hospital by a relative or neighbor and were met by their family physician or an on-call hospital physician who assessed them and then summoned any specialists and operating room staff that were needed. Except in large urban centers, most hospitals did not have the emergency department staff available today. EMS, as we know it today, had its origins in 1966 with the publication of Accidental Death and Disability, The Neglected Disease of Modern Society, known more commonly as the White Paper. This report, prepared jointly by the Committees on Trauma and Shock of the National Academy of Sciences National Research Council, revealed to the public and Congress the serious inadequacy of pre-hospital emergency care and transportation in many areas. As a result, Congress mandated that two federal agencies address these issues. The NHTSA of the DOT, through the Highway Safety Act of 1966, and the Department of Health and Human Services, through the Emergency Medical Act of 1973, created funding sources and programs to develop improved systems of pre-hospital emergency care. This explains why EMS is administrated at the federal level through the DOT and not the Department of Health. In the early 1970s, the DOT developed and published the first curriculum to serve as the guideline for EMT training. To support the EMT course, the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons prepared and published the first EMT textbook, Emergency Care and Transportation of the Sick and Injured, in 1971, often called the Orange Book. The textbook you are reading is the 10th edition of that publication. Through the 1970s, following the recommended guidelines, each state developed the necessary legislation, and the EMS system expanded throughout the United States. During the same period, emergency medicine became a recognized medical specialty, and the fully staffed emergency departments that we know today became the accepted standard of care. In the late 1970s, the DOT developed a recommended national standard curriculum for the training of paramedics and identified a part of the course to serve as training for EMTs. During the 1980s, many areas enhanced the EMT national standard curriculum by adding EMTs with higher levels of training who could provide key components of ALS care and advanced life-saving procedures. The availability of paramedics and ALS-level care on calls that require or benefit from advanced care has grown steadily in recent years. In addition, with the evolution in training and technology, the EMT and AEMT can now perform a number of important advanced skills in the field that were formerly reserved for only the paramedic. This growth and sophistication of the EMS system did not come without its drawbacks, as each state sought to create a system that would meet the needs of its citizens. The definitions of EMS providers began to vary from state to state. For example, in some states, EMTs were allowed to administer medications, while in other states they were not. In the 1990s, NHTSA again began an examination of EMS from a national perspective, with the Council of EMS Providers, physicians, fire chiefs, nurses, state administrators, educators, and other interested parties. NHTSA created the EMS Agenda for the Future. This important document creates a plan to standardize the levels of EMS education and EMS providers in an effort to ensure a more seamless delivery of EMS care across the country. The skills you will be learning and the scope of practice that EMTs now enjoy are part of this national movement toward an EMS system that meets the needs of an ever-changing healthcare industry and meets those needs through a safe and efficient method. Levels of training. As discussed earlier, licensure of EMTs is a state function subject to the laws and regulations of the state in which the EMT practices. Each state is granted the ability to control the functions of its licensed individuals. For this reason, there remains some variation from state to state on the scope of EMT practice, as well as training and recertification requirements. Here is how the system is supposed to work from the federal level down to the local level. At the federal level, NHTSA brought in experts from around the country to create the National EMS Scope of Practice Model. This document provides overarching guidelines as to what skills each level of EMS provider should be able to accomplish. Table 1-2 shows the guidelines from that model. The next step is at the state level. Because licensure is a state function, laws are enacted to regulate how EMS providers will operate and are then executed by the state-level EMS administrative offices, which control licensure. Finally, the local medical director decides the day-to-day limits of EMS personnel. For example, the medications that will be carried on an ambulance or where patients are transported are the day-to-day operational concerns in which the medical director will have direct input. The national guidelines are intended to create a more consistent delivery of EMS across the country. The only way a medical director can allow an EMT to perform a skill is if the state has already cleared that skill. The medical director can limit scope of practice, but cannot expand it beyond state law. Expanding the scope of practice requires state approval. The EMR, EMT, AEMT, and paramedic curricula can be downloaded from NHTSA's website at www.ems.gov. In addition, the National Registry of Emergency Medical Technicians, NREMT, is a non-governmental agency that provides national standardized EMS testing and certification in much of the United States. Many states use the National Registry standards in certifying their EMTs and grant licensing reciprocity to NREMT-certified EMTs. It is important to remember, however, that EMS is regulated entirely by the state in which you are licensed. Public Basic Life Support and Immediate Aid. With the development of EMS and increased awareness of the need for immediate emergency care, millions of laypeople have been trained in BLS CPR. In addition to CPR, many individuals have taken first aid courses that include bleeding control and other simple skills that may be required to provide immediate essential care. These courses are designed to train individuals so those in the workplace, teachers, coaches, childcare providers, and others, can provide the necessary critical care in the minutes before EMTs or other responders arrive at the scene. In addition, many individuals, such as those who regularly accompany groups on camping trips or are in other situations where the arrival of EMS may be delayed because of remote location, are trained in advanced first aid. This course includes BLS and the essential additional care and packaging that may be necessary until the help of rescuers and EMTs can be obtained at a remote location. One of the most dramatic recent developments in pre-hospital emergency care is the use of an automated external defibrillator, AED. These remarkable devices, some no larger than a cellular phone, detect treatable, life-threatening cardiac arrhythmias, ventricular fibrillation, and ventricular tachycardia, and deliver the appropriate electrical shock to the patient. Designed to be used by the untrained layperson, these devices are now included at every level of pre-hospital emergency training. Emergency medical responders. Because the presence of a person who is trained to initiate BLS and other urgent care cannot be ensured, the EMS system includes immediate care by EMRs, such as law enforcement officers, firefighters, park rangers, ski patrollers, or other organized rescuers who often arrive at the scene before the ambulance, and EMTs. EMR training provides these individuals with the skills necessary to initiate immediate care and assist the EMTs on their arrival. The course focuses on providing immediate BLS and urgent care with limited equipment. It also familiarizes the student with the additional procedures, equipment, and packaging techniques that EMTs may use, and the EMR may be called on to assist. In addition to professional EMRs, EMTs often encounter a variety of people on the scene eager to help. You will encounter Good Samaritans trained in first aid and CPR, physicians and nurses, and other well-meaning individuals with or without prior training and experience. Identified and used properly, these individuals can provide valuable assistance when you are short-handed. At other times, they can interfere with operations and even create problems or danger for themselves or others. It will be your task in your initial scene size-up to identify the various persons on the scene and orchestrate well-meaning attempts to assist. Emergency Medical Technician. The EMT course requires approximately 150 hours, more in some states, and includes the essential knowledge and skills required to provide basic emergency care in the field. The course serves as the foundation on which additional knowledge and skills are built in AEMT training. On arrival at the scene, you and any other EMTs who have responded should assume responsibility for the assessment and care of the patient, followed by proper packaging and transport of the patient to the emergency department if appropriate. Advanced Emergency Medical Technician. The AEMT course and training are designed to add knowledge and skills in specific aspects of ALS to individuals who have been trained and have experience in providing emergency care as EMTs. These additional skills include IV therapy, use of advanced airway adjuncts, and in many states, the knowledge and skills necessary to administer certain medications. The purpose of this level of EMS provider is to deliver an expanded range of skills over those of the EMT. In some parts of the United States, the availability of paramedics is limited. AEMTs help to fill the gap by providing limited ALS care to regions where paramedics are not available. Paramedic. The paramedic has completed an extensive course of training that significantly increases knowledge and mastery of basic skills and covers a wide range of ALS skills. This course ranges from 800 to more than 1,500 hours, usually equally divided between classroom and internship training. Increasingly, this training is offered within the context of an associate's degree or bachelor's degree college program. Components of the EMS system. The EMS Agenda for the Future is a multidisciplinary national review of all aspects of EMS delivery. The goal is to develop a more cohesive and consistent system across the country. In the document, there were 14 components of an EMS system outlined. NHTSA has taken these components and organized them in such a way to understand some of the interrelationships between the components. Figure 1-6 demonstrates how the components interact. The tabs on the right side show the primary 911 components regarding EMS. Someone recognizes an emergency, 911 is activated, the ambulance is dispatched, and emergency care and transportation are administered. In the center are the essential aspects needed to allow the primary 911 components to function: finances, radios, computers, and people. The left side demonstrates the continuum of care from the pre-hospital environment to the emergency department and beyond. Finally, as the patient leaves the healthcare system, there are strategies of prevention and education to help ensure people live long and healthy lives. Understanding the 14 components will help you better understand how the EMS system works. Public access. Easy access to help in an emergency is essential. In most of the country, an emergency communication center that dispatches fire, police, rescue, and EMS units can be reached by dialing 911. At the communication center, trained dispatchers obtain the necessary information from the caller and, following dispatch protocols, dispatch the ambulance crew and other equipment and responders that may be needed. This communication center is called a public safety access point. In an enhanced 911 system, the address of the caller is displayed on a screen. The address remains on the screen until the dispatcher removes it. Therefore, if the caller is unable to speak or hangs up, the location remains displayed. However, many cellular phones do not yet have this capability. Most emergency communication centers also include special equipment so that individuals with speech or hearing disabilities can communicate with the dispatcher via a keyboard and printed messages. In some areas, rather than 911, a different special published emergency number may be used to call for EMS. Training the public in how to summon an EMS unit is an important part of the public education responsibility of each EMS service. Enhanced 911 systems are now becoming available that can identify not only the cellular phone number from which an emergency call is being placed, but also the exact geographic coordinates of the phone at the time the call is made. Such systems use Global Positioning System, GPS, technology. Because cellular phones capable of transmitting a GPS signal and a system capable of receiving that signal are both required, the technology will require additional time and resources to implement. A system called Emergency Medical Dispatch, EMD, has been developed to assist dispatchers in providing callers with vital instructions to help them deal with the medical emergency until the arrival of EMS crews. Dispatchers are provided with training and scripts to help them relay relevant instructions to the callers. The system also helps dispatchers select appropriately resourced units to respond to a request for assistance. It is the dispatcher's duty to relay all relevant and available information to the responding crews in a timely manner. Keep in mind, however, current technology does not allow the dispatcher to see what is actually going on at the scene, and it is not uncommon for you to find the reality of the call quite different from the dispatch information. Communication systems. With the information provided by the caller, the dispatcher will select the appropriate parts of the emergency system that need to be activated. In most municipalities, EMS is a part of the fire department. In others, it is a part of the police department or is an independent public or private service. In some areas, a contractor may provide either BLS or ALS service, while in other areas, a hospital-based program, possibly covering several towns, may provide the ambulance services. New technologies are constantly being developed that can assist responders in locating their patients. As previously described, cellular telephones can be linked to GPS units to display their location. Responding units can transmit their position to a dispatcher, and he or she can transmit the location of a call to a moving digital map in the unit, complete with turn-by-turn directions. Medical databases can be queried, and patient information can be directly downloaded to the EMT's computer or uploaded from the EMT's laptop to the database. Constant training and education are required to keep the EMT's knowledge of technological developments up to date. Clinical care. The clinical care component describes the various pieces of equipment and scope of practice for using that equipment. As an EMT, you will use a wide range of different emergency equipment. During the EMT course, you will be introduced to and learn how to use a variety of appliances and devices that you may need on a call. You will also learn when the use of each is indicated and when it is of no benefit or may cause harm. Although the use of different models and brands of a given device will follow the same basic principles and methods, some variation and peculiarities may exist from one model to another. When you join a service, you should check each key piece of equipment before going on duty to ensure that it is in its assigned place, that it is working properly, and that you are familiar with the specific model carried on your ambulance. Each EMT may be called on to drive the ambulance. Therefore, you must familiarize yourself with the roads in your primary service area, PSA, or sector. The PSA is the main area in which an EMS agency operates. Before going on duty, you should check all the equipment and supplies and communication equipment that the ambulance carries. It is also the EMT's responsibility to ensure that the ambulance is fully fueled, has sufficient oil and other key fluids, and that the tires are in good condition and properly inflated. You should also test each of the driver's controls and each built-in unit and control in the patient compartment. If you have not driven the specific ambulance before, it is a good idea to take it out and become familiar with it before you respond to a call. Maintenance and safe driving of the ambulance are discussed in detail in Chapter 36. Human resources. The human resources component deals with people. Who delivers the care? How are these people compensated for their time and energy? How do other members of the medical community interact and participate within the EMS world? These are some of the questions that are discussed within the component of human resources. EMS in this component is examined as a profession. The overarching concept is to encourage the creation of EMS systems that provide an environment where talented people want to work and can turn their passion into a rewarding career. Several objectives need to be accomplished to help make a career in EMS a lasting one. Efforts are being made to ensure that EMS providers can move from one state to another more seamlessly. From a global point of view, one of the core functions of a state is to provide and protect its citizens. This obligation has led to the creation of EMS levels that are unique to a particular state. Though effective for any one state, these idiosyncratic EMS levels make movement from one state to another complicated. One of the functions of the national scope of practice model is to create stable foundations on which each level of EMS provider is grounded. The net effect is to encourage a more consistent definition of what is an EMT, so providers can move more freely about the country. The EMS Agenda for the Future encourages the creation of systems that help to protect the well-being of EMS providers. It also encourages systems to develop career ladders, allowing talented EMS providers ways to use that talent for many years. Medical Direction. Each EMS system has a physician medical director who authorizes the EMTs in the service to provide medical care in the field. The appropriate care for each injury, condition, or illness that you will encounter in the field is determined by the medical director and is described in a set of written standing orders and protocols. Protocols are described in a comprehensive guide delineating the EMT's scope of practice. Standing orders are part of protocols and designate what the EMT is required to do for a specific complaint or condition. The medical director provides the ongoing working liaison between the medical community, hospitals, and the EMTs in the service. If treatment problems arise or different procedures should be considered, these are referred to the medical director for his or her decision and action. To ensure the proper training standards are met, the medical director determines and approves the continuing education and training that are required of each EMT in the service and approves any that individuals obtain elsewhere. Medical control is either offline, indirect, or online, direct, as authorized by the medical director. Online medical control consists of direction given over the phone or radio directly from the medical director or designated physician. The medical direction can be transferred by the physician's designee. It does not have to be transferred by the physician himself or herself. Offline medical control consists of standing orders, training, and supervision authorized by the medical director. Each EMT must know and follow the protocols developed by his or her medical director. The service's protocols will also identify an EMS physician, usually at a local hospital, who can be reached by radio or telephone for medical control during a call. This is a type of direct online medical control. On some calls, once the ambulance has initiated any immediate urgent care and gives its radio report, the online medical control physician may either confirm or modify the proposed treatment plan or may prescribe any additional special orders that the EMTs are to follow for that patient. The point at which the EMT should give their radio report or obtain online medical direction will vary. Legislation and regulation. Although each EMS system, medical director, and training program has latitude, their training, protocols, and practices must conform to the EMS legislation, rules, regulations, and guidelines adopted by each state. The state EMS office is responsible for authorizing, auditing, and regulating all EMS services, training institutions, courses, instructors, and providers within the state. In most states, the state EMS office obtains input from an advisory committee made up of representatives of the services, service medical directors, medical associations, hospitals, training programs, instructors associations, EMT associations, and the public in that state. At the local level, each EMS service operates in a designated PSA in which it is responsible for the provision of pre-hospital emergency care and the transportation of the sick and injured to the hospital. EMS services are usually administered by a senior EMS official. Daily operations and overall direction of the service are provided by an appointed chief executive officer and several other officers who serve under him or her. When the EMS service is part of a fire or police department, the department chief will usually delegate the responsibility for directing EMS to an assistant chief or other officer whose sole responsibility is to manage the EMS activities of the department. To provide clear guidelines, most services have written operating procedures and policies. When you join a service, you will be expected to learn and follow them. The chief executive of the service is in charge of both the necessary administrative tasks, e.g. scheduling, personnel, budgets, purchasing, vehicle maintenance, and the daily operations of the ambulances and crews. Except for medical matters, he or she operates as the chief, similar to a fire chief or police chief, of EMS for the service and the PSA that it covers. Integration of health services. EMS does not work in a vacuum. EMS personnel travel to people's homes and to vehicle collisions. Once on scene, they deliver care and transport the patient to a care facility. Integration of health services means that the pre-hospital care you administer is coordinated with the care administered at the hospital. When you deliver a patient to the emergency department, you are simply transferring that patient to another care provider. The excellent care that you began is simply continued in the emergency department. This component helps to decrease errors, to increase efficiencies, and most of all, to ensure the patient receives comprehensive continuity of care. Evaluation. The medical director is responsible for maintaining quality control, ensuring that all staff members who are involved in caring for patients meet appropriate medical care standards on each call. To provide the necessary quality control, the medical director and other involved staff review patient care reports, audit administrative records, and survey patients. Continuous quality improvement, CQI, is a circular system of continuous internal and external reviews and audits of all aspects of an EMS system. To provide CQI, periodic run review meetings are held in which all those who are involved in patient care review the run reports and then discuss any areas of care that appear to need change or improvement. Positive feedback is also discussed. If a problem appears to be repeated by a single EMT or crew, the medical director will discuss the details with the individuals involved. The CQI process is designed to identify areas of improvement and, if necessary, assign remedial training or develop some other educational activity. The medical director is also responsible for ensuring that appropriate continuing education and training are available. Information and skills in emergency medical care change constantly. You need refresher training or continuing education as new modalities of care, equipment, and understanding of critical illnesses and trauma develop. Equally, when you have not used a particular procedure for some time, skill decay may occur. Therefore, your medical director may establish a training program to correct the deficit. For example, an emergency department physician noted that despite their assessments, many EMTs were missing a high number of closed long bone fractures, resulting in poor pre-hospital care. A subsequent audit of calls led to a review and retraining session for assessment and care of fractures. This same process can apply to CPR or any other type of skill that you do not use often. Ensuring your skills and knowledge are current is one of the ongoing commitments of being an EMT. Another function of the evaluation process is to determine ways to limit or eliminate human error. During the delivery of EMS, as with any occupation, there are times when errors can happen. Driving to the scene can be hazardous. As you are lifting and moving a patient, the patient can be dropped. Communicating with other EMTs or transferring the patient to the emergency department presents circumstances where errors can happen. Remember that errors can occur at any point during the call that can result in harm to the patient, public, and you. Errors are not inevitable. If the circumstances of the errors are understood, it may be possible to eliminate or at least minimize them. There are many ways to examine medical errors. For the purpose of this text, errors have three possible sources. They can occur as a result of a rules-based failure, a knowledge-based failure, or a skills-based failure, or any combination of these. For example, does the EMT have the legal right to administer the particular medication needed by the patient? Has the medical director given permission to administer the drug? If not, a rules-based failure has occurred if the EMT assists with the administration. Does the EMT know all of the pertinent information about the medication being delivered? If not, a breakdown at this point, such as the administration of the wrong medication, would be referred to as a knowledge-based failure. Finally, is the equipment operating and being used properly? If not, a skills-based error has occurred. Any error can come from multiple sources. How to limit errors requires work from both the EMS agency and EMS personnel. Agencies need to have clear protocols, which are detailed plans that describe how certain patient issues, such as chest pain or shortness of breath, are to be managed. These protocols need to be understood by all EMTs within the service. The environment can be part of the reason for errors. Are there ways to limit distractions? How do we improve lighting so EMTs can see well? How organized is the equipment? Can the EMT find what he or she needs in a timely manner? Environmental considerations can be managed using many approaches. Sometimes the solution is as easy as ensuring flashlights are available on all ambulances. Maybe this means having police assistance on certain types of EMS calls. Maybe an EMS supervisor can provide assistance. Perhaps a new type of equipment bag will provide better organization. Typically, when trying to reduce environmental factors regarding errors, this means having the right people with the right equipment in place. EMTs themselves can also help to reduce errors. Your job is to protect the patient from harm and to deliver high-quality medical care. This is one of your most important responsibilities. You are a patient care advocate. You speak for patients on their behalf. Keeping this responsibility in mind will help you to limit errors. There are other ways errors can be reduced. When you are about to perform a skill, ask yourself, why am I doing this? Knowing the reason for your actions allows you time to reflect and make a more informed decision. Even within EMS, rarely do you have to act so quickly that you do not have a moment to consider what it is you are doing and why. If you have considered what to do and cannot come up with a solution, ask for help. Talk with your partner, contact medical control, or call your EMS supervisor. Another way to help limit medical errors is to use cheat sheets. Have a copy of your protocol book with you. Emergency physicians have many reference materials available to them. Physicians recognize they cannot memorize everything, so referencing a book or an internet resource helps ensure the accuracy of their memory. Finally, after a troublesome call, sit down and talk. Talk with your partner and/or your supervisor. Discussing the events that just happened provides an excellent avenue for learning. Your discussions can help lead to changes in protocol, how equipment is stocked, or even the purchase of new equipment. Information systems. EMS is not unlike any other profession in today's world. Without computers, the job would be much more difficult. An information system allows EMS providers to document the care that has been done. Once that information is stored electronically, it can be used to improve care. How many times has a department seen patients with chest pain? What is the average on-scene time for major trauma patients? How many AED runs has the department had? These questions and many more can be answered with the information from computerized medical records. This information is now used for a variety of purposes. It is used to construct educational sessions for the department. Data from ambulance activity logs can be used to justify hiring more personnel. Examining the types of patients can provide the foundation for the purchase of new equipment and guide continuing education sessions. This information can also be combined with other computer resources, such as from a hospital, to determine patient outcome. Departments from around the country are sending information to Washington, D.C., so a national snapshot of EMS can be obtained. The National EMS Information System, NEMSIS information, can be found at www.ems.gov. This information can be used to better plan for the needs of EMS systems today and in the future. System finance. All EMS departments need a funding system that allows them to continue to provide care. However, the type of system needed depends on many variables. There are several types of EMS departments around the country. The Journal of Emergency Medical Services annually reports on how EMS is delivered within the United States. See Table 1-4 for the breakdown of types of EMS services within the United States for the year 2008. These departments may have paid or volunteer personnel, or a mix of both. Financial resources are available for EMS departments through taxation, fee-for-service, paid subscription, donations, federal, state, local grants, fundraisers, or combinations of same. Which financial system is used depends on the needs and makeup of each EMS department. How are EMTs involved with the financial side of EMS? You may think the financial aspect belongs to those who work in the office. However, you may be asked to gather insurance information from patients or to get written permission from patients to bill their health insurance company. EMTs are involved in helping with fundraisers, stuffing envelopes, or just making calls to potential subscribers to the service. Regardless of what type of system you will be working in, you will be helping the department secure its financial resources. Education systems. Your training will be conducted by many knowledgeable EMS educators. In most states, the instructors who are responsible for coordinating and teaching the EMT course and continuing education courses are approved and licensed by the state EMS office or agency. To be licensed in some states, an instructor must have extensive medical and educational training and teach for a designated period while being observed and supervised by an experienced instructor. Generally, ALS training is provided in either a college, adult career center, or hospital setting. In most states, educational programs that provide ALS training must be approved by the state and have their own medical director. In these courses, many of the lectures and small group sessions are presented by the medical director or other physicians, nurses, and EMT instructors. In clinical sessions in which supervised practice is obtained in the emergency department or other in-hospital settings, students are also supervised directly by physicians and nurses. The quality of care that you will provide depends on your ability and the quality of your training. Therefore, your instructor and the many others who developed and participated in your training program are key members of the emergency care team. Once you no longer have the structured learning environment that is provided in your initial training course, you must assume responsibility for directing your own study and learning. As an EMT, you will be required to attend a certain number of hours of continuing education approved for EMTs each year to maintain, update, and expand your knowledge and skills. In many services, the required hours are provided by the training officer and medical director. In addition, most EMS education programs and hospitals offer a number of regular continuing education opportunities in each region. You may also attend state and national EMS conferences to help keep you up to date about local, state, and national issues affecting EMS. Because there are many levels of licensing, you should ensure that the continuing education you receive is approved for the EMT. Whether you take advantage of these opportunities depends on you. You may decide to remain an EMT, or you may want to achieve a higher level of training and certification. But whatever your choice is, the key to being a good EMT and providing high-quality care is your commitment to continual learning and increasing your knowledge and skills. EMTs possess special knowledge and skills that are directed to the care of patients in emergency situations. The authority that is delegated to you to care for patients is a very special one. Maintaining your knowledge and skills is a substantial responsibility. Knowledge and skills that are learned in any profession weaken when they are not used on a continual basis. As an example, consider the steps involved in CPR. If you have not used these skills since your original training, it is unlikely you will perform CPR proficiently. Continuing education and refresher courses are measures you can take to maintain your skills and knowledge. Prevention and public education. The next two components of the EMS system are often closely associated with each other. Prevention and public education are aspects of EMS where the focus is on public health. Public health examines the health needs of entire populations with the goal of preventing health problems. Although there are many definitions possible for public health, the prevention of health problems seems to provide a good overarching framework. Healthcare in the United States is currently in a state of flux. The high-tech, on-demand style of care that is prevalent has two major drawbacks. One, it is very expensive. In the United States, more than 15% of the gross domestic product is accounted for by healthcare. Two, it may not deliver a better product. The U.S. government reports that people born in the United States have an average life expectancy of 78 years. There are 49 other countries where people are living longer. If we're spending such large sums on health care, shouldn't we be living longer? What needs to be addressed is the concept of prevention. Is it more expensive to treat a patient with a heart attack or to work with communities to help prevent the heart attack from happening? Or consider the scenario of an EMS provider working with a community to help get new traffic lights installed, thereby decreasing the incidence of vehicle collisions and subsequent injuries. The concept of prevention can also apply to both the patient and the EMS provider. Eating right, exercising, and using other stress management techniques can help prevent medical emergencies. It may seem strange, but the goal of education should be to create an environment where the need for EMS is decreased. The focus of the public health arm of healthcare is prevention. Public health works to prevent illness and injury, meaning being proactive. A good example of public health at work is the common product, salt. The next time you buy salt, look at the contents. In the United States, salt is sold with the additive iodine. It was discovered years ago that certain thyroid diseases, such as gout, are caused by a decrease in iodine levels within people's diets. The solution was to add this important element into a commonly used food source. Today, gout is rare within the United States. Table 1-5 demonstrates other significant accomplishments of the public health system. EMS is able to work with public health agencies on both primary and secondary prevention strategies. Primary prevention focuses on strategies that will prevent the event from ever happening. Polio was a devastating disease causing death and disability for thousands of Americans. It was discovered that a vaccine could be developed to prevent the disease. In the span of one generation, the disease was virtually eliminated. Vaccinations are a good example of primary prevention within public health. In 2009, the World Health Organization declared the swine flu, H1N1 virus, to be at pandemic levels, which meant that the virus had spread throughout the world. At the writing of this text, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has determined that the outbreak of this virus within the United States is limited. If a major outbreak of this virus were to occur in the United States, EMTs may be called on to assist in the administration of vaccinations. Other examples of primary prevention include ensuring people know the dangers of drinking and driving, and the harmful effects of using tobacco and other drugs. In a secondary prevention strategy, the event has already happened. The question is, how can we decrease the effects of the event? Helmets and seat belts do not prevent the accident from happening, yet they do prevent serious injuries from occurring due to the accident. The next time you drive down a major roadway, take note of the construction of the guardrails. There have been significant changes in their construction over the years as more information has become available on what happens during a vehicle collision. EMTs may also be involved in the surveillance of illnesses and injuries. The patient care reports that are generated by EMS personnel can be used to determine if a serious, widespread condition exists. For example, EMS is in a perfect position to provide statistical information to the local government about collisions. Injury surveillance data can be used to determine ways to improve a dangerous intersection, to prevent accidents from ever happening, or to limit the severity of injuries to drivers. As discussed earlier, EMTs can help educate the public. People may not understand why an accident has happened. A parent allows her 15-month-old child to play outside with other children unsupervised. The child falls and cuts her hand. EMS arrives, and the cause of the injury is obvious. EMTs can work with the parents professionally, respectfully, and kindly to help educate them on how to prevent this injury from occurring in the future. The public may not understand the education that EMS providers have and what services they can provide. EMTs can go to local schools and teach children to call 911 when there is a medical emergency. EMS personnel can work with local healthcare institutions to inform local residents when to call for an ambulance and when other transportation methods are more appropriate. Teaching people how to perform CPR, how to help a choking victim, or even how to assist in the delivery of a baby are all aspects of public education. One of the important effects of public education is an increase in public respect for EMS. When people understand what it means to work on an ambulance and provide care to the sick and injured, they are more likely to consider EMS a vital part of the public health care system. This change in attitude can be powerful and lead to increased EMS funding and greater respect for EMS as a profession. EMS research. Why do EMTs perform the skills they do? How many ambulances does a city need? Should we remain on the scene and stabilize the patient, or should we transport the patient rapidly? These questions and thousands more like them help determine the shape and impact of EMS on the community. The answers to these questions need to be derived from research. Unfortunately, many of the tools and techniques that EMS providers use are borrowed from other healthcare settings without any research proving their effectiveness. In the early days of EMS, it was believed that major trauma patients needed to be stabilized on the scene before they were transported. Paramedics would start IVs and use advanced airways. There was no foundation to support this behavior. It was assumed that this care needed to be done. After compiling significant amounts of pre-hospital EMS research, it was determined that major trauma patients needed to be transported to an operating room more than they needed an IV. Now, EMS providers provide rapid transport of major trauma patients to trauma centers where they can get the surgical care they need. This is the power of EMS research. Evidence-based medical decision-making is the direction in which medical care is moving. It asks, can you prove that your therapy works? EMTs will be involved in research typically through gathering data. You may be part of a study to determine how much oxygen should be given to patients with shortness of breath. You may be involved in a study to track the time it takes to get serious trauma patients to the emergency department. Your job will be to ensure you record all of the information about these patients carefully. The information gathered will then be analyzed by others to answer the questions. The results could then be shared with the rest of the EMS community to change patient care practices. Traditional medical practice is based on such research. Research can also be done at each EMS facility. EMS personnel can examine patient care records to determine where the department can improve. This information is then used to generate educational sessions for the EMTs, or it can be used to plan public education, public prevention strategies. High-quality patient care should focus on procedures useful in improving patient outcomes through sound research. It is important for EMS providers to stay up to date on the latest advances in medicine. Every 3 to 5 years, the American Heart Association unveils a revised set of guidelines based on large amounts of evidence. The American Heart Association is an excellent example of evidence-based medical decision-making in progress. These changes occur because more information is known. One word of caution: when reading new research, make sure you understand what the results mean. Research information can be powerful, but it is often powerful within a very limited setting. A manufacturer of a defibrillator boasts that their new machine will terminate ventricular fibrillation on the first shock 95% of the time. On the basis of this information, you may want to immediately buy this new product. Terminating ventricular fibrillation is certainly a positive result, but does this defibrillator save more lives than other defibrillators? In this example, the manufacturer is reporting that the defibrillator is able to terminate ventricular fibrillation, not that the defibrillator is able to save more lives. People who do not examine the research will often make that hasty conclusion. Be skeptical when reading research. Ask questions and conduct some of your own research. Conclusions that seem too good to be true are usually not true. Roles and responsibilities of the EMT. As an EMT, you will often be the first healthcare professional to assess and treat the patient. As such, you have certain roles and responsibilities and are expected to possess certain attributes. The guiding principle for EMS personnel is everything you do needs to be done with the patient in mind. What is in the best interest of the patient? This is referred to as being a patient advocate. Often, patient outcomes are determined by the care that you provide in the field and your identification of patients who need prompt transport. You are responsible for all aspects of EMS, from the preparation of the equipment to the delivery of care, to providing a good example for others within the community. Professional attributes. As an EMT, whether you are paid or a volunteer, you are a healthcare professional. Part of your responsibility is to make sure patient care is given a high priority without endangering your own safety or the safety of others. Another part of the responsibility to yourself, other EMTs, the patient, and other healthcare professionals is to maintain a professional appearance and manner at all times. Appearance, including uniforms, hair length, and tattoos, are usually regulated by the policies of your department. Your attitude and behavior must reflect that you are knowledgeable and sincerely dedicated to serving anyone who is injured or in an acute medical emergency. A professional appearance and manner help to build confidence and ease the patient's anxiety. You will be expected to perform under pressure, with composure and self-confidence. Patients and families who are under stress need to be treated with understanding, respect, and compassion. Most patients will treat you with respect and appreciation, but some will not. Some patients are uncooperative, demanding, unpleasant, ungrateful, and verbally abusive. You must be non-judgmental and overcome your instincts to react poorly to such behavior. Remember, when individuals are hurt, ill, under stress, frightened, despondent, under the influence of alcohol or drugs, or feel threatened, they will often react with inappropriate behavior, even toward those who are trying to help and care for them. Every patient, regardless of his or her attitude, is entitled to compassion, respect, and the best care that you can provide. Most individuals in this country can obtain proper routine medical care when they are ill and are surrounded by relatives and friends who will help to take care of them. However, when you are called to a home for a medical problem that is clearly not an emergency, remember that for some individuals, calling an ambulance and being transported to the emergency department is the only way to obtain medical care. As a new EMT, you will be given a lot of advice and training from the more experienced EMTs with whom you serve. Some may voice a callous disregard for some types of patients. You should not be influenced by the unprofessional attitude of these individuals, regardless of how experienced or skilled they appear. As a healthcare professional and an extension of physician care, you are bound by patient confidentiality. You should not discuss your findings or any disclosures made by the patient with anyone but those who are treating the patient or, as required by law, the police or other social agencies. When discussing a call with others, you should be careful to avoid revealing any information that might disclose the name or identity of patients you have treated. Be careful not to gossip about calls and patients with others, even in your own home. The protection of patient privacy has drawn national attention with the passage of the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, HIPAA. You should be familiar with the requirements of this legislation, especially as it applies to your particular practice.